Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you. It's Tuesday, the 10th of November. Welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up in Uganda, the opposition claims that the 2016 presidential election campaign is getting off to a bumpy start.
This electoral commission is not an electoral commission of the people of Uganda. It's an electoral commission of the dictator. This campaign is starting a month late because Mr. Museveni was not yet a candidate. He was not ready.
And in South Africa, a temporary reprieve for dozens of students who face charges after defying a court order to halt their protests.
The state has taken a decision to withdraw the charges. Pending further investigations.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
In just over 3 months' time, Ugandans will be going to the polls, and eight presidential hopefuls, including incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, have now started campaigning. Observers say the two main contenders who have any hope of unseating Museveni are Kizza Besigye and Amama Mbabazi. Alex Jitter reports.
Hundreds of people followed the candidates through the streets of Kampala, donning their party colours to show their support. Ugandans have been promised a first world country by each of the eight candidates, from President Yoweri Museveni to the least known candidate, Maureen Walube. All Ugandans have to do is vote wisely, as they are constantly reminded. Of the candidates hoping to unseat President Yoweri Museveni after his 30-year rule, many are his former allies. Dr. Kizza Besigye, who is now running for presidency for the fourth time, is Museveni's former private physician. He was also a minister in Museveni's government and a leader in the Ugandan army. Although Besigye has managed to get through the nomination process, he believes the ground is not leveled for a free and fair election.
This electoral commission is not an electoral commission of the people of Uganda. It's an electoral commission of the dictator. I went to the electoral commission and said, thank you, you've nominated me, but you must go. You are the people that we were protesting. You must go. Sorry. Look at what they did. This campaign is starting a month late because Mr. Museveni was not yet a candidate. He was not ready until 3 days ago.
Besigye has acquired a great deal of grassroots, but some of his high-profile supporters of the Forum for Democratic Change Party have abandoned him for Amama Mbabazi. Mbabazi was Museveni's prime minister and secretary general of the ruling party until September last year. In his first campaign rally, Mbabazi attacked Museveni for using the army and the police against Ugandans.
The time for change is now. Our society increasingly divided and militarized, with a government increasingly hostile to its own citizens.
Mbabazi said he had no room to share his ideas while working with President Museveni. But according to the other candidates, Mbabazi is not different from his former boss. Professor Venantius Baryamureeba criticized Mbabazi for spearheading the Public Order Management Bill that gives the police the power to decide over who holds a public rally. Baryamureeba is a former head of Makerere University. He has kicked off his campaign with the promise of transforming the education sector.
My heart bleeds for teachers who earn peanuts and yet continue to transform students into leaders of this country. And this journey will end with every Ugandan at another level. To end with Ugandans getting better education and better health services. To end with farmers improving their earnings. It will end with our youth proudly employed.
President Museveni himself attacked all his opponents, describing them as people who fail to do their jobs.
The people have problems, they need a solution. Besigye deserted us in 2001. I have solved all those problems. Without Besigye, now Besigye comes back to say, erect me, erect, you abandoned us. Mbabazi has abandoned work. Well, I dismissed him as the prime minister because he was not doing his work.
Museveni kicked off his campaign in central Uganda district of Luwero, where he started a rebellion that brought him to power 30 years ago. This time, the government has been asked to allow candidates to freely address their supporters without being interrupted by riot police.
Alex Jetta in Kampala. And just before the start of campaigning, the rights group Human Rights Watch urged Uganda to ensure that the elections were free and fair. The group said it was concerned about police brutality, obstruction of the media, and a lack of accountability for past election violence. Maria Burnett is a senior researcher at the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, and my colleague Crispin Mwahideo asked her whether Museveni, in power for almost 30 years, would play fair this time round.
I think that that's very difficult to feel confident about, given President Museveni's long stay in power, given his profound control over the levers of state power, and given what we've seen just even in the last few months as far as the partisan policing of public rallies, what we already have documented over many years about the way the ruling party can control access to the media, it's very difficult to say there's a level playing field for Uganda's elections.
And talking of the statement or the article that you wrote about the Uganda's election campaign, you are calling on Ugandan authorities to avoid repression of the media, particularly, and police brutality. Are you anticipating any violence against the opposition candidates?
Well, we've done work on Uganda's elections for many years now, and each time we have seen sporadic violence. Clearly, the 2001 elections were quite violent. The 2006 elections, the opposition had a lot of problems. You know, Dr. Bezige faced numerous partisan prosecutions. He was really hamstrung in his ability to campaign. The 2011 elections were more peaceful, but there were a lot of allegations of the use of state money to buy votes and voter bribery. Whether we'll see actual violence this time around, obviously, we certainly hope not. But at the end of the day, the important thing is that the opposition is free to campaign, that all sides feel that they can go on the radio and express their views without fear of reprisals, and journalists feel free of, you know, that they can host the opposition without potentially facing reprisals.
You actually singled out one incident where an opposition candidate was being hosted for a radio show and somehow there was a technical glitch and power went out and it couldn't go on. You seem to push or to at least speak out for the opposition. The Ugandan government could almost argue that you're supporting them.
No, we don't support any side. Human rights, the government has a legal obligation to uphold human rights. They are the duty bearer of the human rights convention that, you know, Uganda has signed over many years. When we talk about free access to the media, obviously all sides' views should be presented. Voters can't be informed by all sides unless they can hear from all sides.
You're also concerned about the police recruitment of hundreds of thousands of young people known as crime preventers. Why is that? Why are you concerned about this initiative?
Uganda, like many countries in the region, has a long history of recruiting sort of ad hoc groups to help with security, but often we see them playing a partisan role. In Uganda, this new program to recruit crime preventers is troubling because it's not clear what their exact mandate is. It's not clear that they have any specific legal mandate. That is, there's no actual law or regulation that would control their activities. They're not getting paid, but they're receiving some form of training, police training, military training. And it's very, very, very large numbers. You know, the government is throwing around ultimately having a million or more crime preventers throughout the country. We've had access to some of the training materials that coordinators of crime preventers have put together. And those documents read as partisan documents. They read as, you know, that the forces should be loyal to President Museveni. And ultimately, you know, that's troubling.
Maria Burnett, senior researcher with the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
A candlelit vigil is to be held in Nigeria later today, marking the 20th anniversary of the execution of the Ogoni writer and environmental activist Ken Sarawiwa. He was hanged, along with eight other activists, after what was widely condemned as a military show trial. Nigeria, back then, was governed by military ruler Sani Abacha. This report by Birgit Morgenrath has been adapted for Africa Link by Eunice Wanjiru.
Environmental activist Ken Saro-Wiwa led a protest movement aimed at stopping the oil giant Shell from continuing to operate in the Ogoniland region of the southern Niger Delta. A charismatic leader, he called for peaceful change.
Great Ogoni, land of honor, great Ogoni, land of wealth. I warn the people of Ogoni, we will not fight with machetes. Our fight is one of intellect and peace. No blood should be spilt.
This was to be the last message that Saro-Wiwa would convey to his followers.
The world has seen how the Ogoni people have risen up. They have seen that the government cheats us and that Shell is destroying us.
Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight of his followers were hanged at dawn on November 10, 1995. Eyewitnesses say that the small, stocky man held his head high when the last hour came. Saro-Wiwa, a former government official, television producer, and a winner of the Right Livelihood Award, the Alternative Nobel Prize, died at the age of 54. A military tribunal sentenced him to death after allegedly finding him guilty of incitement to murder. Four Ogoni leaders had been found murdered, and the regime of Nigeria's military ruler, Sani Abacha, blamed Saro-Wiwa and his followers. In 1990, Saro-Wiwa founded MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. The group argued that oil production had devastated the region's environment while bringing no benefit to ordinary people. Saro-Wiwa said that Shell had turned what was once an area of unspoilt natural beauty in a grubby black moonscape. Oil from dilapidated pipelines and pumping stations seeped in soil and destroyed it. For local residents, Nigeria's oil reserves hadn't brought affluence, just poverty and disease. MOSOP protested loudly and called on Shell to clean up the pollution and share the proceeds from its oil sales with the region's population. Oil accounts for 90% of Nigerian state revenue, and various military regimes and their corrupt associates used this money to finance a life of luxury. On January 4, 1993, MOSOP arranged a huge rally attended by some 300,000 people defying a government ban on public demonstrations. This became known as the First Ogoni Day. The government also declared that disturbances of oil production would henceforth be treated as acts of treason.
And that report was written by Birgit Morgenrath.
Africa on the Move.
And let's return to Uganda for this week's Africa on the Move. Young IT students are working on an app that can speed up the detection of breast cancer, a disease which is on the increase in Uganda. Grit Hoffman met the developers, and her report is presented by Jane Ayoko.
Maurice Atwine and David Mwesigwa are students of information technology and belong to Uganda's new IT elite. Their breast cancer detection app comes in form of a glove with sensors connected to a mobile phone. As the main brain behind the app, Maurice explains what motivated him.
I personally lost a relative to breast cancer, and that's how we came up with the idea. So with breast cancer in Uganda, particularly Africa, there is a low incidence rate, meaning the growth rate is high, but the survival rate is kind of down.
Early detection is crucial when it comes to saving lives. The biggest problem in rural areas where there is lack of specialist doctors is that breast cancer is detected too late. The first point of contact for many patients experiencing pain in rural areas is the rural doctor. Maurice and David are keen to get their feedback on the app. Do the ultrasonic sensors provide accurate information about irregularities in the breast? Would the rural doctors pay $350 for the app that would allow them to pass on information to specialists in capital Kampala? Rural physician Dr. Dennis Mitty is impressed by the invention.
I think it is going to be very, very, very important if it is brought on market. Small centers like this, we cannot afford a mammograph, we cannot afford ultrasound, but we can afford this.
No one knows why breast cancer is increasing in Uganda. One theory is that it may be linked to changes in what people eat. Activists want to raise awareness about the importance of early breast cancer detection. But fear of being stigmatized in their villages make many women ignore the first signs of the disease. Rebecca Mayengo is a survivor of breast cancer and has first-hand experience of prejudice and discrimination. She now spearheads the awareness campaign.
They don't want to be associated with you or your family. They don't want to. They may not want to marry in your family, you know. And there are many chances the husbands leave their wives. And also the employers may not continue to employ you.
Healthcare is one of Uganda's biggest challenges and also one of its biggest markets. Some of Morris and David's friends are working on an app for the early diagnosis of malaria and tuberculosis. They say there are many opportunities in this field, but there are also problems.
There are very, very many technology kids who are interested in technology. Kids do a lot of different stuff.
But there's limited technology and the resources are really limited.
I look abroad and I see that the world is ahead of us. And we're like, maybe out of 10, we're at step 1, and someone is already at step 9, about to reach 10.
Every second Ugandan is under 15 years of age, and the tech scene is thriving. With more support, young people could help unlock the potential.
And that report was written by Grit Hoffman. Student life has many challenges. Over 100 South African students appeared in court in Johannesburg on Monday. They'd been charged with defying a court order to halt their protests against the outsourcing of jobs done by non-academic staff on university campuses. The charges against the students were dropped pending further investigations. Only recently, South African students persuaded the government to climb down over proposed tuition fee increases. Tuzo Kamalo reports.
The 144 students and workers were arrested on Friday for violating a court order barring them from holding their protests within 500 meters from the University of Johannesburg campus. They spent Friday night behind bars before being freed on Saturday and warned to appear in court on Monday. During their court appearance on Monday, most of them were in high spirit. They vowed to continue the strike until the university offers its non-academic staff permanent contracts. There was even more jubilation amongst the group when the National Prosecution Authority's Pindile Law brought the news on their temporal freedom.
After careful considerations of what is contained within that docket, the state has taken a decision to withdraw the charges. Yeah! Pending further investigations.
Fezekan Hlebi, a cleaner at the University of Johannesburg, also received the news of their temporal freedom with jubilation.
Hey, I'm so happy about the charges that we have been thrown. I don't know what to say to those lawyers who are standing there for us, those kids, those parents, to everybody. We are so happy that the charges are thrown by now.
University of Johannesburg and the workers' representatives on Sunday signed an agreement to end outsourcing, but Mangaliso Mkonda, Secretary General of the Students' Representative Council at the University of Johannesburg, says they reject that agreement.
That agreement, we do not embrace it, we dismiss it because there was no proper representation. Workers were not represented by their own unions. They took a mere worker from the ground, general worker, to go and sign on behalf of all workers.
After the court session, students and the workers returned to the University of Johannesburg to continue with their protests. Police were forced to use stun grenades to disperse them. The protesters vowed to regroup and continue the protest, describing their fees must fall protest as a revolution. Some likened it to the 1976 Soweto youth uprising that has been accredited for climaxing the struggle that ended apartheid in South Africa. In their case, they say, it's a revolution that will make education free for all South Africans. Examinations in all universities have continued despite these protests.
Tuzo Kamalo in Johannesburg.
Making a difference.
And as we heard earlier in the programme, healthcare continues to be a major challenge in African countries. Ghana is no exception. Many lives are lost because of the lack of adequate medical facilities in impoverished communities. In one of Ghana's biggest slums, a retired nurse has set up a health post to attend to patients, pregnant women in particular. Isaac Kelechi explains how she is making a difference.
Mamobi Niman is one of Ghana's biggest slums. It is home to over 300,000 people. Like any other slums, Mamobi Niman suffers from lack of social infrastructure. In this slum, access to healthcare is a big challenge. Now, one woman nurse has come to the aid of the people living here. Hajia Damata, a retired nurse, has opened up a small clinic where she offers professional medical care. The premises is only 100 square meters, but many find solace while here. Hajia Damata Sulemana is a specialized nurse. With her over 30 experience in public hospitals, she handles both men and women.
The community is such that when they are sick, they don't come to hospital early. They will sit down till the condition is at the deterioration stage. So since I've also adopted myself to that situation, in the evenings I sit down quietly to wait for them to come because I said I will save life so that at least I can also help to save their lives.
Hajia's clinic has been operating for more than a decade now. The demand for the services offered here is so high, yet the facility is not expanding. Hajia is not spared from the economic hardship faced by many in this area.
I'm looking for funds to expand the space so that we can have a theater within the facility so that we can do almost everything that they will need to support them, save their lives.
Majority of the patients here are pregnant women requiring midwifery attention.
I was very sick. I couldn't eat, but by God's grace, I'm doing well now. I and my family members have always come to this facility, and we're doing fine. Hajia does very well, and she treats her patients well. May God bless her.
Mahmoud Suli has malaria. He's here for treatment.
Oh, it's fine.
Since I came here, they have treated me very fine, and there is much respect for patients. What the matter is doing here is fine, and the cost is affordable.
Samira works with Damata and is full of praise for her boss.
Hajia is very nice woman, kind, everything. She's like a mother to everyone. They feel very comfortable and very happy to be here.
For Damata, her inspiration is to help those living in this community, and she will stop at nothing in fulfilling that every day.
What motivates me is that, you know, most of the times, even somebody that you've attended to will come back and say, Hajia, thank you for your treatment, your care. And when I went home, I'm okay. And she'll bring another person. And that alone, looking at it, good names, they say good names are better than riches. So that good name that goes out there, you know, I'm also happy and it keeps me running, continue to do the work.
One thing is certain for sure, for every patient Damata attends to in this community, that life has been saved and nothing is more inspiring than this.
And that was Isaac Kelechi reporting from Accra. Before we leave you, a reminder of our main stories here on Africa Link. Campaigning is now underway in Uganda ahead of the presidential elections in February. A candlelit vigil is to be held in Nigeria today in memory of Ken Sarawiwa, the Ogoni environmental activist who was executed 20 years ago. We've also been hearing about South African students protesting against the outsourcing of jobs done by non-academic university staff. We welcome your comments on this programme, either in a text message to country code 49 160 957 595 10, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. As always, thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.